In 87, Huey released this. Four, their most accomplished album. I think their undisputed masterpieces, Hip to Be Square. A song so catchy, most people probably don't listen to the lyrics. But they should, because it's not just about the pleasures of conformity and the importance of trends. It's also a personal statement about the band itself. Hey, Paul!
To show you.
You know what? That's the last time I bring you a motherfucking sandwich, and the last time I bring you a motherfucking bag of chips.
No, I'm looking forward to that fucking sandwich. Oh, that's coming out good. Are you ready? You ready?
Yeah, let's
you
do ready? It. Let's
all right. Do it. Welcome everybody to the Horrible People's Podcast. I almost never introduce it. But this week, among the craziness that's happening nationally, yep. Internationally, everything, Alex got sick. Hopefully not the coronavirus, but we just did learn this information earlier this morning.
Fingers crossed.
So fingers crossed. I think she's okay. She's throwing up, so that's totally not a symptom.
she's just throwing up.
She's
big deal.
Gonna be fine. Yeah, you know, diarrhea, whatever. But, no, I don't. That's not true.
You want to cut that? Yeah, you might want to cut that.
No, that's staying in. But we promised you a guest last week, so
here I am.
Here she is, Sydney Gabrielov. Hey,
hey.
Tell everybody a little about
Thanks
yourself.
For having me.
Yeah, no worries.
I am a human being, and I am a fan of this podcast.
There,
so
yeah,
here
you go.
I am.
Two things I enjoy for the most part.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
And this will actually conclude my birthday month, which is a big month for the
Yay.
Podcast. Almost as big as Alex's birthday month, which was a huge hit last year.
Almost.
Almost there. Almost there. So this, I wanted to end this shit with a movie that I felt was kind of America at the time, so much that it actually has the word American in the title.
You are right.
So what movie would that be, Sydney?
American Psycho.
American fucking Psycho.
One of my favorites.
Oh my gosh. And again, before we get in there, Alex, I hope you're okay. We'll find out in a week, and I'll update you all guys, but I'm sure
I know,
she'll be fine.
I was looking forward to Alex being here.
Yeah, I actually wrote this with three people in mind.
Anthony is significantly less cool, but
that's
you'll
fine.
Do.
You know, it's my birthday. I you're on this shit. me and Sydney known each other almost a year by this
yeah,
point.
Yeah, we're going to
so.
Be ragging on each other a
yeah,
lot. So
yeah, get used
you
to that
gotta
shit.
You just got to get used to
yeah.
it. Yeah. But
as always, whenever we have a guest, you get to kick us off with the IMDb synopsis.
Oh, yay.
And
is
all
that
the
somewhere
good
on this piece of paper that I'm looking
that
at?
That is this whole fucking thing right there.
Beautiful.
Yeah. By the way, Sydney's the only person that's ever printed this shit out. In all of our podcast existence.
I was in the office. I wanted to peruse before, you know,
yeah,
we recorded.
No, she wants that whole newspaper man feel right there. I get it.
All right, should I go ahead?
Yeah, do it.
Let's do it. All right. A wealthy New York City investment banking executive, Patrick Bateman, hides his alternate psychopathic ego from his coworkers and friends as he delves deeper into his violent, hedonistic fantasies. I just okay. love the word hedonistic.
I like the word hedonistic.
It's,
yeah.
It just rolls off the tongue.
And that, and I'm like, if somebody's like, calls you a hedonist, I'm like, yeah. Cool.
I'm a goddamn
hedonist.
I enjoy life.
Yeah,
sure.
Exactly. This is one of the few IMDb synopses, whatever mm-hmm. it is, that's good.
No, that was spot on.
Yeah.
That was spot on.
As a listener of this podcast since its inception, pretty much, like,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
No, that's the best one. They're usually kind of lackluster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
not great. Yeah.
The worst ones were all the movies during Black History Month of all things. So,
yeah,
you know,
I noticed that.
IMDb's
yeah.
a little hard-leaning on some of these things. So.
Assholes.
Oh, ready for this one. By the way, guys, if you haven't seen the movie, I would suggest you pause this podcast.
Yeah,
and
if you haven't seen it, why are you listening to this?
No.
Go watch the film. It's really good.
It's really goddamn good.
The novel was written by Brett Easton Ellis. The script was written by Mary Harron and Guinevere Turner. And it was directed by... It was directed by Mary Harron as well?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm tripping. I thought it was directed by Oliver Stone.
No.
I'm just kidding.
All fucking most.
It is starring Christian Bale, Willem Dafoe... love him.
Yeah.
Jared Leto, don't love him. Josh Lucas, Samantha Mathis, Matt Ross, Bill Sage, Chloe Sevigny. Is it Sevigny?
I always say Savini. Savini? I'm not
Chloe
sure.
Chloe Savini. Either way, I'd love her to death, too. Kara Seymour, Justin Theroux, Guinevere Turner, and Reese Witherspoon.
Jeez.
Box office. All right. The release date was January 21st, 2000 at Sundance and released in the United States on April 14th of the same year. The budget was $7 million, and it grossed $34.3 million. Oh, that's a pretty good turnaround.
No,
yeah,
that's huge.
That's good.
I like that.
I did not know that it made that much.
I'm so fucking surprised $7 million got you that cast right there.
Yeah, that is, yes.
No, like,
because those, most of them were already pretty big names.
Yeah.
Like,
no, seriously, yeah. Reese Witherspoon? Like, I mean, she's in there for like a handful of minutes.
Yeah.
But still.
I mean, she annoys me, so that means that she did a good job.
Exactly.
She did her job.
I feel like a lot of the annoying characters in this film are intentional in that aspect.
Oh, 1,000%. 1,000%. But she pulls it off so well.
No. she's just got that smile, though, when she's...
She's got that little face. That little annoying face.
When I want to love you, I love you. But when I want to hate you, that
right.
fucking face makes me hate you a little more. Yeah.
Yep. Totally.
Oh, but we are about to get into... Guys, this is actually a really big episode. Again, I wrote it for three people. I wrote it for three. But me and Sydney are going to tackle this bitch because...
It's a good one.
It's important.
Yeah.
We kind of have to, especially with what's going on right now in the times.
Yeah.
They can't. You can't see Sydney nodding, but she is. In
oh yeah, you guys can't see me. I am nodding.
Yeah.
Thanks for the subtle reminder.
Yeah. I'm on a podcast.
I need to talk. Sure.
All right. So let's get into this shit. So author Bret Easton Ellis was pretty much a controversial figure right at the beginning of his literary career. He came from the San Fernando Valley region of. Good old wonderful fucking
the
California.
Valley,
yeah.
All right.
He's a Valley boy.
Nice.
But he went to college in at Bennington College in Vermont during the mid 80s, which yeah.
That must have been a great time.
Yeah.
You got to go to Vermont, man.
Have you been to Vermont?
Fuck yeah, I have.
What is Vermont like?
There's a town called Woodstock in Vermont, which is like just quaint. Vermont is beautiful. Farms, covered bridges, fall leaves everywhere.
Jesus.
If it's fall, obviously, but Vermont is idyllic. I digress.
And Bret Easton Ellis did this in that setting with more cocaine. Like that was his
cocaine's a hell of a drug.
That
y'all.
Was his setting right there. Yeah.
Well, he churned out something really great.
He did.
So,
the cocaine helped. No, I agree.
Sure did.
So this actually, speaking of cocaine, was during the height of what is known as yuppie culture.
Yuppies.
Yeah. The yuppie itself means young urban professional, but the term obviously has significantly more implications than young urban professional. It
yep.
just does. So yuppies, according to my sources online and all the I Love the 80s things I watched on VHS when I was younger.
It was like the rich fuckboys.
Yeah.
So today's term would be fuckboy, but they had money.
Yeah. That's the only people that fucked in the 80s. So, no, the really poorest did too. That's how we're all here.
Yeah, exactly. So you and I are here.
Yeah, exactly. Yuppies often lived in the city, more than likely worked in finance,
mm-hmm.
and were socially liberal, you know, at least on the facade level, but were fiscally conservative.
Yes.
Very much on the practical level, and were the spitting fucking image of 80s excess. Like, that's just what they were.
And people hated them.
No, yeah.
They were very hated.
But remember, people liked them at first.
People
did. And that goes into this whole section right here. Journalist Dan Rottenberg had this to say about the group. Quote, "The yuppies seek neither comfort nor security, but stimulation. Hmm. And they can find that only in the densest sections of the city." End quote.
Ooh,
I mean, that's kind of where we're at right now
yeah.
with far less money.
Yeah.
By the way, guys, if you hear a little thing clanking down, we are drinking some
Monster some claws.
Yeah,
in honor
I'm digging
of the
these.
Yuppies, because mm-hmm. if yuppies had claws in the 80s, they would have drank them.
They had Zima. So.
Yeah, this is the Zima of today.
Is,
oh my god,
Zima with a little bit more flavors. That's all it is. But while in school, in the midst of what was known as the Year of the Yuppie. Mm-hmm. 1984, according to Newsweek, Ellis completed work on his first novel, titled less than zero.
Okay.
Yeah, it was the story of a disillusioned college student returning to his home in suburban Los Angeles during winter break and his experiences returning to his hometown.
Yeah, you write what you know, and that's what he did.
That's like all he knew. I mean, when you're like 20, you're just like, oh, I feel everything right now. Yep. Luckily, he's like talent. You know,
oh, clearly. No, no, clearly talented.
So Ellis actually somehow managed to get this fucking book published in 1985 while he was actually still an undergrad.
Impressive.
Dude.
Very impressive.
Yeah, exactly. And he was propelled from this to instant success and what usually comes along with that, instant fucking controversy.
Yep.
So the book was a hit, but it was also critiqued as being very nihilistic. Something that would be, you know, follow the author
on brand
until now.
For him. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. If you listen to his podcast or follow his Twitter, he's a nihilistic motherfucker.
I actually don't know too much about him. I've never read his books. The only thing that I know of him is the American Psycho.
Well, that's what most people do. But
thank you, Brett.
Exactly. Well, I feel like my friends who read novels and shit like all the fucking time because they're much better at this.
Adrian, exactly.
Yep. Like they all understand him. He has a reputation amongst the community, which.
This is making me want to read his novels.
I kind of want to read Less Than Zero, to be honest with
you.
Yeah, but so this is exactly why we're going to get into this portion right here. To quote Ellis, quote, "I get shit all the time for being a cranky old man on the porch, but I don't think I've changed. I think I was that when I wrote Less Than Zero. My temperament is... cranky old man," end quote.
Well, mine too, brother. I'm right there with you.
Yeah. Knowing you this long, I see a hint of Ellis inside of me.
Yeah.
I think we both do when we see some shit. We're like, people are mad about this right now? God damn it.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm crotchety, but I just don't like disrespectful ass people.
No, yeah. I think respect is in short order
We're
nowadays.
Missing a lot of it nowadays. A little
bit.
Yeah.
See, this is it right here.
This is the perfect episode to do, though, right now.
Our diatribe right now is our cranky old man coming out.
Oh, for like, sure.
Yeah, right there.
He wants to say hello.
Yeah, he's just like, yeah, by the way,
fucking people.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. The literary community labeled Ellis a member of the literary Brat Pack.
Oh.
Yeah, which included members Tama Janowitz, I'm going to fuck up some names, Jay McInerney? Yeah. McInerney? Anyway, he's in here a lot,
Close
too.
Close enough.
Yeah, and Jill Eisenstadt, all of which were from the East Coast and were considered the new faces of literature at the time.
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The who's who of... there was the Brat Pack from the... Who was in the Brat Pack?
It was Emilio Estevez.
Yep, Emilio, the Mighty Duckman.
I was like, Emilio! Oh.
Molly Ringwald, right?
Charlie Sheen, Martin Sheen... more Martin Sheen, actually, on that one. Who else? Was anybody in The Breakfast Club or any Tom Hughes movie?
Martin Sheen was his father. So, I don't know if you're right about that.
No. Oh, Emilio Estevez.
Yeah, that's his brother. But he uses their actual
Martin
name.
Martin Sheen, yeah.
Yeah, Sheen is the their stage name.
Yeah, well... As a fellow Latino person, it always breaks my heart that they're like, you can't be famous unless you have a white name.
Either way, I think Emilio Estevez is a way better name.
I think, right? But then Charlie Estevez, not so much. Charlie Sheen sounds a little better.
You're right.
He kind of knew.
When you're right, you're right.
Anthony Michael Hall also. Anthony Michael Hall was in there.
I love that little guy.
Oh, he got buff, though.
He's buff now?
No, he was buff. Remember Edward Scissorhands? He played the fucking bully.
Fuck, you're right. See, I still see him as little nerdy Anthony Michael Hall.
No,
like,
right?
That'll never change.
No, yeah. Ugh, what was he going to be? I can't remember. We're going too far.
Sorry, yeah. Let's get back on track.
See, this is why I know you're meant. This happens. You're filling Alex's shoes 100% right there.
I'm trying.
There you go. Ellis only really associated, though, with J. McInerney. Fuck, I always forget
McInerney,
that.
McInerney.
Who wrote Bright Lights, Big City, and the two engaged in highly, highly publicized nights of fucking debauchery.
Best nights you can have.
We live in Los Angeles. There's plenty of opportunity. But this gave them the distinct label of the Toxic Twins. So, toxic, I think,
That's
is a little
so
mean.
Interesting because, wow, it's so... Okay. There were another pair of Toxic Twins.
Fuck.
Who
I can't
were
remember.
They?
I can't. No, you're right.
There were. It's so interesting that they had their own set of Brat Pack and Toxic Twins in the literary community.
I think the literary community wanted to be cool. They wanted to be cool.
They wanted to be cool.
Yeah.
To me, they are cool.
Yeah, I agree. So, Ellis moved to New York City in the glorious year of 1987, which, yeah, actually wasn't that glorious, though. Besides my birth, of course. So, his second novel, Rules of Attraction, failed to match the success of his first. Mm-hmm. And if 1984 was the year of the yuppie, then 1987 is when America had enough of their yuppie shit.
Mm.
Yeah. So, on October 19th, 1987, the global financial market system was rocked as the Dow Jones Industrial Average saw its largest single-day drop in history. That day would go on to be known as Black Monday. And the ripple effect hit markets all across the globe, which saw a total loss of $1.7 trillion USD that fucking October. Yeah, that hurts. That happened in the year of my birth. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's soul-crushing. My God.
The world now hated the fuck out of yuppies, though. But the new negative connotation and subsequent press that came from it had the unexpected side effect of helping the fledgling New York author, as yuppies were the subject of Bret Easton Ellis' third and most successful novel, American Psycho.
Yeah.
So let's learn a little bit about the conception of this novel. Sydney, bring us in.
So the original conception for the character of Patrick Bateman was more of an earnest, non-violent, boring, and disillusioned character than the one seen in the published version of American Psycho. But one dinner with his friends on Wall Street would change all of that.
Oh, yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Speaking on his original conception, Ellis states Patrick Bateman was, quote-unquote, very passive, watching everything unfold around him, and ultimately not being able to deal with this environment and leaving. Is that what you meant?
No, and leaving.
Okay. I've had a couple claws. I think he had a fiancé, and he was going to get a promotion or something, and everything was centered around drugs and going out in Manhattan every night. This was going to be the earnest novel.
Yeah, it was going to be like some Brat Pack shit. He was like, I'm going to figure myself out and I fucking hate everything. Like,
I'm glad that you changed it.
Yeah. Obviously went way fucking different.
Yep. Something about this dinner made an impression on Ellis, and Patrick Bateman went from a passive character to that of a serial killer. Ellis found Wall Street excessive, the values of which frustrated him, but he also found himself occasionally sympathetic to the whole thing as he was in New York trying to fit in and chase the American dream. Mm. That'll do it.
Chasing the American dream in Los Angeles, yeah.
Yeah, here we are.
Yeah, here we are.
On this, Ellis says, quote unquote, I might have been disgusted with the values then and what it meant to be a man, a successful man, but where else was I going to go? There was one particular figure which would become a fascination of main character Patrick Bateman that would exemplify all this during the time between 1987 and 1990 as Ellis was writing his prolific work. Yes, we're going to talk about Donald Trump.
Yep, we're going to talk about Donald fucking Trump. Birthday month, yeah.
Let's do it. To quote Bret Easton Ellis, it was really kind of an eye roll that this kind of nouveau? Nouveau riche?
Yeah, I guess.
Sure. This kind of rich guy with not great taste, became the man that so many other young men looked up to. Well said.
Mm-hmm.
Even as the era of the yuppie died down, Donald Trump still somehow survived mostly unscathed. At least image-wise.
Mm-hmm.
Glad you put that in there because about to...
His finances were a little fucked after that, yeah.
That was if you didn't look too closely, which a lot of Americans weren't because we're still talking about the Reagan era. Oh, the shade.
Yeah. Well, by the way, before we started recording, we bitched about Reagan for like 4 minutes.
Yeah, he sucked.
He was bad.
He was really awful.
Ugh.
Ellis found himself fascinated with Trump, going as far as to even get his haircuts in Trump Tower and spending lots of time there to get ideas for scenes. One such scene occurs towards the end of the novel where Bateman, in full manic mode, pauses to gaze at Trump Tower and finds himself drawn to it, along with the urge to kill young black men.
Eek. Eek.
Yikes.
Ah.
Bret Easton Ellis knew about Donald and Fred Trump's discrimination toward non-whites when housing their apartment buildings. He knew about his fixer, Roy Kahn, and the psychotic philosophies he instilled on the future president. And he even followed the Central Park Five case, which saw Trump call for the death penalty of five young black men accused of brutally attacking a jogger, even after they were proven innocent of the crime. DNA testing is a wonderful thing.
It is.
And, yeah, I'm not surprised that a rich white man was a tad bit racist.
Yeah, he's just, no, lock him up, kill him. Ugh. And was it Roy Cohn? I can't remember. But he's the one.
Don't know.
He's the one.
Good old Roy.
Good old Roy. Motherfucking old Roy. No, he's the one that told him, like, never compromise, never admit you're wrong, and always attack, always attack, always attack. That was his philosophy.
So be a sociopath.
Yep, actually. Exactly.
Cool. Mm-hmm. As we rage in 2020, Ellis raged throughout the late 80s and early 90s, but could still not curb the obsession he had with the divisive figure. This is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to his own revelation that would fuel the creative force behind the novel. Ellis was living the Patrick Bateman life.
In New York? Yeah.
This is great. He was frustrated with himself, living the consumerist lifestyle. He poured that rage into his novel. He also came up with a second revelation, that Donald Trump was the father figure Patrick Bateman didn't have, someone he wanted to connect with and emulate. Now, Bret Easton Ellis had a novel and proposed release date of March 1991, but controversy, of course, wouldn't be far behind. American Psycho was about to rock the literary landscape.
Yep, it was, shit's about to go down right now, so I do find that
this is heavy, man.
Yeah, no, isn't that crazy though? He's like obsessed with Trump, but he fucking hates him.
I didn't know any of that.
Yeah,
like that. Wow.
He was so anti-Trump before people were anti-Trump. Like he was literally like, "You guys are all idiots. Don't you see what's going on?"
Right, yeah, I love that. I love that.
Oh, you're not gonna love some of the other stuff coming up though. So
yeah, I skimmed the script.
You skimmed. You know what's coming.
I know what's coming. Yeah. I'm gonna hold my tongue until then.
We're just gonna get hot. All right. So, American Psycho was originally going to be published by New York-based publisher Simon and Schuster. Jesus.
Sorry, they're very famous.
No, that's good. That's good. Simon and Schuster. But that obviously did not happen. Early reviews were very, very, very fucking negative.
Go figure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Time Magazine and Spy Magazine both detailed the contents of American Psycho to their own readers, and the outrage within these articles gave publisher Simon and Schuster cold fucking feet. So the higher-ups...
Doesn't surprise me.
Yep. Richard E. Snyder and Martin Davis, who chaired the publisher and its parent company, respectively, decided that the backlash was so severe and made an 11th hour decision not to publish American Psycho.
Oh.
Yeah, so this was going to go out. And they were like, nope, sorry.
And that's a huge publisher. Like, that's the only reason I know how to pronounce that.
Because right? Yeah.
That's pretty big.
Clearly not a reader on my front. So...
Shaman, I'm here to make Shuckster. You look good. I'll
just
shut up.
No, please. No. Throw shade. It's good.
Shaman and Schuster.
So this was a huge, huge blow to Ellis. But luckily, his novel caught the attention of Sonny Mehta. Mehta? I can't. But the head.
The doozy.
Yeah. Sonny was the head of Vintage Books, who assumed that the publicity would result in huge sales, and they assumed correctly.
Marketing, baby.
Yep.
Come on.
So this was all detailed in the New York Times article. Snuff this book. Will Bret Easton Ellis get away with murder? I wrote stuff this book, audience. That's not... No.
That's why I'm chuckling.
Stuff this thingy.
Stuff it.
In this article, author Roger Rosenblatt states, quote, "Several times in the middle of some childishly gruesome description of torture and dismemberment, I found myself chuckling with revulsion."
So he got it.
Yeah, yeah. He got it, but he was holding his britches right there, whatever.
Good word. Great word.
One publication did appear to get what Ellis was going for, though, with Henry Bean of the Los Angeles Times, good old LA right there, concluding his review with the statement, quote, "What Ellis fully understands is the politics of social irresponsibility, the electoral strategy initiated by Richard Nixon, which has reached full flower in the Reagan-Bush years." Mm-hmm. American Psycho tells of the greed and soullessness to which we have all yielded in our way, and that leads inexorably to to gratuitous murder. To murder as our final expression of disgust and plea for judgment.
Ooh.
Yeah, wow.
Spot on.
That's much better than the other fucking guys.
I kind of like Roger Rosenblatt's quote.
Yeah, no, it's good.
But chuckled at dismemberment.
I like this, like, but this is what Reagan was about. It's very powerful. But soon, however...
Oh, he was chuckling with revulsion.
Yeah.
Oh.
No, he hated it.
Roops.
Yeah, Rosenblatt was like, fuck this book. It's
fuck
disgusting.
Fuck you, Roger Rosenblatt. Yeah.
And then Bean was just like, this is what's all going on.
Yep.
But soon, however, the literary world would turn completely on Ellis in almost actually unprecedented way. They have not had this kind of backlash in fucking ages.
Damn.
So to put it in the author's own words, quote, I think I was going through this trial by fire, end quote.
Mm.
Yes.
That's rough.
a week after the good review from Henry Bean, the Los Angeles Times printed a 3-page letter section of nothing but people canceling their subscriptions in protest. Because it's still the fucking 80s and Reagan still had its moral motherfuckers.
Time to crack claw.
Yeah, no, that was a good crack right there. You're just Chris. Like, ah, fucking protest. By the way, what discovery did you make during this one break right now? Toxic Twins?
Oh, the Toxic Twins were Steven Tyler and...
Keith Richards, was it?
No, I was wrong. It was Steven Tyler and who's the other guy from Aerosmith?
Oh, fuck me. Steven Tyler and other.
There. I'm so embarrassed. I know this, guys.
You're almost there.
I so know this.
It's just when you crack the claw, it was right. How was lemon, by the way?
Refreshing.
All right,
kinda
cool.
Tastes like
it.
Lemon pledge I'll at the same it. Time, so I don't know how I feel about it.
Our fucking Zimas. Okay. Oh, my God.
On brand.
Right on fucking brand. During Ellis's Christmas vacation, right in the middle of the worst of this fucking controversy, Gloria Steinem and the National Organization for Women were leading a panel talking about how vintage books had a moral obligation not to publish American Psycho. He saw this right when he turned on CNN. Right when he turned it on, it was just like, by the way, this piece of shit. He's like, I'm on vacation.
There's bigger fish to fry, Gloria Steinem.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that's going to turn around on her in a little bit. So, the New York Times ran around 18 articles total.
Wow.
Protesting the book.
That's
all about
a lot.
American Psycho. Yeah. At least according to Ellis's recollection, which he's actually pretty accurate because I looked at
his
sources.
That means he did something right. Like, if no one's angry about your book, then you probably suck, right?
Yeah, exactly. No, he made an impact.
He made
a fucking impact,
yeah.
Exactly. But again, this did not slow down vintage books at all, who released American Psycho in motherfucking 1991.
That's what I'm motherfucking talking about.
Yep.
Fuck you, Simon and Schuster.
Shuckster and motherfucker.
Shuckster and fuckers.
It's going to be like Idiocracy where we're just going to go further.
Where it goes
further.
From Buttruckers to Buttfuckers.
Oh,
I love
God.
That you've seen that.
That's a good
yes,
movie.
It is.
Dude, Mike Judge is ahead of us. You know how much we watch King of the Hill?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure do.
Me and Sydney watch a lot of King of the Hill, by the
a
way, fans.
Lot.
Like, we both, like yeah. She'll come over and we'll just, like, marathon this bitch.
Yeah.
Ugh. Also, Ho Yeah Podcast. Great podcast, by
amazing
the way.
Podcast.
So good.
If you ladies are listening to this, I love you.
Sydney loves you. Yes. So in Australia,
mate.
And New Zealand, American Psycho was given an R18 rating.
Ooh.
Yeah. And was only allowed to be sold shrink-wrapped to prevent minors from reading its content.
Just like a Playboy.
There you go, see? One bookshop owner was even raided by the police for disobeying this.
What a strange time.
Yeah. In Germany, sales and marketing for the novel were severely restricted. They couldn't say shit about this. They essentially just put it on the shelves. And in Canada, serial killer Carla Homolka...
Oh, that fucking bitch.
Oh, yeah.
They were brutal. Awful.
They were fucking
Carla
brutal.
And Paul... Paul Homolka.
No,
if
no,
you
no
have
Paul
not,
Bernardo.
Paul Bernardo.
Paul Bernardo.
I knew his name was Paul.
Yeah.
They were fucking awful.
No, exactly. They were the Ken and Barbie killers.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a fan of this book.
Oh.
Yep. So after all this backlash and bad press, American Psycho became a huge cult hit.
Go figure.
It garnered a lot of academic fascination, and Bret Easton Ellis's, it just became his most successful novel of his entire fucking career.
His magnum opus.
It was his magnum fucking opus, number three. So naturally, a film adaptation was in order. And this one was going to be directed by a female and star Gloria Steinem's stepson.
The fuck?
Yeah. Though that wasn't the original plan. Let's explain that one.
Well,
let's get into it. Let's see why the fuck that didn't happen, or did happen.
All right. So in 1992, producer Edward R. Pressman, who was working on an adaptation of The Crow. Oh, I love that movie.
Check our Crow episode for more.
It's so good.
A little sad.
Bought the rights to American Psycho and had the perfect man for the lead, Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp, huh?
Johnny Depp. I'm not even going to go there.
No.
This obviously didn't pan out, as Pressman had another problem to deal with, finding the right director. Pressman reached out to reanimator, director Stuart Gordon to direct the project, but these plans fell through. Next was David Cronenberg, who would work.
God.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying not to fangirl while reading this.
God,
all right,
yeah.
Let me get through this, man.
Yeah.
Who would work with a script by Bret Easton Ellis himself. Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Though this proved to be as frustrating, as Ellis was so bored with the material by this point, he topped the film off with a musical number set to Barry Manilow's Daybreak, set atop the World Trade Center. Yeah, that's going to be a hard no
for
me.
Yeah, no, he basically shit all over that.
Yep, clearly.
No, he did, yeah.
Anything, put Barry Manilow in anything and it's just...
As we just watched Can't Hardly Wait. Oh, a good movie. Good movie,
such
not a
good
horror movie.
Yeah. Needless to say, Cronenberg went with a different writer as production went on before backing out completely. Just as Bateman, Ellis just wasn't there, and Pressman felt no one really got the material until Mary Harron came into the picture.
Fucking
that's right.
Boss.
Bring a lady in.
Oh, Harron's awesome.
Mary Harron got her start writing for Punk Magazine in New York City, being the first person to interview the Sex Pistols for an American audience.
Gush away. Just gush away. It's fine.
Did you write this with me in mind?
I did.
Because
I'm
dying
did.
Right now.
I think this was your original section.
Oh, my God. Okay, if you don't know this about me, I love the Sex Pistols. I love punk music. I love New York City in the 70s. When I was like 13, I was obsessed with Sid and Nancy. Yes, I was 13 and obsessed with two dead junkies. I digress.
Obsessed with two dead junkies, Sydney's other fucking stand-up
you
special.
You can fucking quote me on that.
Yeah.
After her career working for publications, she made her way to PBS to produce Edge, a series that examines American pop culture. One particular story about Valerie Solanas helped her to create her first feature film, I Shot Andy Warhol. The film didn't make the most money, but it was well-received by critics, enough to put her on the map for the adaptation of Ellis's controversial novel. According to Pressman, Harron was the only one who got what was needed to make American Psycho work. She loved dark material. She saw satire as the main focus. Harron had the perfect person for the role of Patrick Bateman as well. Future Obi-Wan Kenobi, Ewan McGregor. What?
Yeah, that was her choice.
Another hard no for me, but okay. However, there was another actor more hungry for the role, future Batman Christian Bale.
Mm-hmm.
I know this has said a lot about actors and like I couldn't see anyone else in that role, but like I couldn't see anyone else in that role. Like I really couldn't.
Ewan McGregor would I can't even see Ewan McGregor in an American accent really. Like so to see him like do this, nah.
Bale knew that McGregor was working on Star Wars and that his career was going to go in a way different direction, smart, so he begged the actor to turn down the role, which he totally did.
Yeah, fucking smart.
Good boy. Bale had been on Harron's radar already, and with all the other choices out of the picture, she decided to give the young actor a shot. After receiving the offer, Bale received what can only be quantified as a shit ton of messages telling him that the role was career suicide. This only made him more excited for the role.
Yep.
My dude.
Yeah, no, I take it.
I love him. In 1998, Christian Bale met with Bret Easton Ellis to get approval for the role, and he came in character as Patrick Bateman. Ellis describes this experience as seriously unnerving to be a fly on that wall.
I know, right?
That's amazing.
He's like, let's go to this restaurant. It's like, the one in the novel? Oh, fuck.
Oh, you can get reservations for Dorsey?
Yeah, is that for Dorsey? That's right. Oh, that's awesome. So, while Mary Harron was excited as shit to actually have Christian Bale on this project, because she knew he got it, Lionsgate felt he just wasn't famous enough for the lead. Yeah, and they went behind her fucking back.
Of course they did.
Of course.
Hollywood.
To reach out, they wanted to reach out for one more actor who they were hoping would be interested. Leonardo DiCaprio. Yeah.
Okay.
The studio sent over a copy of the script and a $20 million offer.
God damn.
Yeah, the budget was going to be $30 million. $20 million, that was going to go to Leo.
For that fuck ass? Come on.
Yeah. And this was enough, actually, to get the Titanic star's commitment to the project. He was interested.
All right, I take back fuck ass. I love Leo DiCaprio.
I love
but he's
him,
not.
But like,
he was not right for this role.
No,
no, definitely.
Definitely
not.
Yeah, and this was right immediately after Titanic. So he was like on top of the fucking...
Right, but
yeah.
He was like pretty boy.
How do you...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, definitely not. But Lionsgate announced DiCaprio's involvement at the 1998 Cannes Film Festival.
Cannes? Yep.
Cannes
it's
Film
French,
Festival.
Baby. That S is silent.
Oh, whatevs. Which stunned both Harron and Bale. After the announcement, Mary Harron refused to meet with the new star.
Wait. They announced that shit behind her back?
Yeah. Yeah. They went over her fucking head. Oh, yeah. Hollywood.
I'm getting angry.
You've heard this podcast before, so.
Sure have.
Yeah. She refused to meet the star, and she said he had way too much baggage, mm-hmm. citing his, quote, 13-year-old fan base, end quote. Yeah. That was the main reason right there. She also felt he just straight up wasn't right for the part. He just wasn't in her eyes.
Good for her for standing her ground, though.
I mean, clearly,
yeah.
you watch the movie, she has a vision.
Yeah,
she has
no,
a vision.
She got the novel.
But Lionsgate
she
was just
it.
Like, but money!
Yeah.
You fuckers. So this announcement also reinvigorated the massive, massive backlash and protests from the novel. And led...
Oh!
Yep. Yeah, this reinvigorated those protests and brought back in Gloria Steinem, future stepmother to Christian Bale, in the forefront.
Which is so weird.
I know.
This is
no,
so, like,
that's
this is so intertwined.
A little
yeah.
oddly incestuous right there.
Yeah, that's weird. But cool.
But with that, though, and all this fucking heat, Mary Harron was promptly fired from the project. Yep. DiCaprio then drafted a list of directors he wanted to work with, which included the likes of Martin Scorsese and Danny Boyle. Hell, Jonathan Demme and even Stanley Kubrick were considered, but absolutely no female directors were on this list.
Come on, Leo.
No. He was...
Don't disappoint me, brother.
This is 1997.
He was still young,
yeah.
Yeah.
He was a little baby.
Yeah, he didn't
exactly.
know.
He had Critters and the Titanic under his belt. No, Gilbert Grape also. Now, he knew what he
Which
was
is
doing.
A fantastic
great
film.
Movie.
He was also on Growing Pains.
Oh, that's
lest
right.
Lest we not forget.
That's right. Good old TV. But finally, Lionsgate found its director and were ready to go ahead with the project. Oliver Stone.
Yeah. I just watched Natural Born Killers last night.
What do you think? How do you feel about Natural Born Killers?
I love it. Yeah, hence why I watched. I meant like I watched it, for the umpteenth time last night.
No, it's a good one.
Mickey and Mallory Knox, baby.
You know, and he did good in Wall Street, so I could see why they would pick him. Wall Street's
yeah.
a good movie. Wall Street's a good one.
It's
yeah.
a film.
It is a film.
It's not
film.
A movie.
Yeah,
it's
no,
a film.
You're right. It is. Wall yeah. Street's a great film. So Mary Harron felt his decision, however, was terrible, as Stone's approach was always far more psychological than it was satirical. In her words, he just didn't get the film. He
didn't get it.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, he's a great director, but yeah, sometimes people aren't right for the material.
Absolutely, yeah.
But she wasn't alone in this, as Leonardo DiCaprio and Oliver Stone did not work well together, both fighting over control of the film's fucking direction. They button heads.
Leo was too big for his britches at that time.
No, he was trying to make some big changes.
You don't fight with Oliver Stone.
Oh, yeah.
Like, sit down, little boy. It's Oliver fucking Stone.
Fucking Gordon Gekko was written because the writer saw how Oliver Stone talked on the phone and was like, I'm going to make the character like that.
That's amazing. I never
yeah.
knew that.
That's why you don't fight with Oliver Stone.
Yep.
He's actually Gordon Gekko. So,
that's amazing.
That's probably why he directed it so well, too.
Right?
So, to quote producer Edward Pressman, quote, Leo was looking for solutions to things that weren't problems when he first started. End quote. Yeah, he kind of dug his own grave on that one.
Yep.
But finally having a chance to work with Danny Boyle, Leonardo DiCaprio abandoned the project to work on The Beach. Yep, and that was that.
Is a very polarizing movie. I'm not going to call The Beach a film.
Yeah, that's a movie.
It's a movie. I can take it or leave it.
Yeah, I agree. It's middling. Yep. But Danny Boyle's a good director, so, you know.
Absolutely.
Everybody has their movie like that. They do.
Yeah.
But during this time, Mary Harron was keeping her silence, playing the Hollywood game, and not ruffling feathers with the higher-ups who fired her ass, all while commiserating with Christian Bale on the phone.
Smart girl.
She was smart.
She was smart.
She knew the game.
Yep.
However, it didn't help that while this was going on, Bret Easton Ellis was publicly expressing interest in DiCaprio.
Mm.
So Ellis states, quote, "I'm sure it pissed off Christian, and I'm sure Mary wasn't pleased to hear it," end quote.
You think?
Yeah. However, Mary Harron knew Leo wouldn't go through with it. She just knew. And she was still on good terms with Edward Pressman. Christian Bale passed on projects for 9 fucking months while Stone and DiCaprio fell apart.
So he really wanted this.
It was his dream role.
He really, really wanted
it. No, this is his dream fucking role.
And you
role
can tell
there.
It comes across in the film.
You can tell from the first line.
Yep.
Yeah, he
1,000%. He
knew
did.
It. To quote Mary Harron, "Everyone thought we were crazy." So, however, in the end, after months, and I mean months of silence, Lionsgate came to Harron with an offer and profuse apologies for the shit they put her and Bale through. Yeah, I didn't put the quote in there, but she was like, "They apologized and were begging me to come back."
Sheepishly.
Yeah, exactly. Their only stipulation was that the budget not exceed $10 million and that the supporting cast be made up of known bankable actors.
And that they did.
Mary Harron kept that bitch under $8 million and cast Chloe Savini, Jared Leto, Reese Witherspoon, and Willem Dafoe, among others, in key supporting roles. So she's like, "All right, cool, $10 million? I'm going to give you 2 extra so you can market this bitch and add a bunch of stars."
I'm in love with her.
Oh, she's fucking great.
I am in love with her.
She's great.
But
of course, the movie had to be made. So let's get into it.
She did a good job. American Psycho was shot in Toronto among massive protests from a group called... Oh, this makes me laugh.
Yeah, I know, right?
Concerned Canadians Against Violence in Entertainment.
Oh, you bet they said sorry so many times.
You bet. You bet they did. Sorry.
This film's about violence.
I love that, Concerned Canadians. Mary Harron felt this was unjustified. None of the protesters had read the script, and similar films received no such protest at the time.
Mm-mm.
7 and 8 millimeter never attracted the same kind of outrage, says Harron.
Yeah, and 8 millimeter is a fucked up film.
Never seen it.
Don't ever watch it. It's bad. It's bad. It's bad and stupid. Like it's graphic.
Never
and
even
dumb.
Heard of it.
Yeah, no.
Seven,
Cage.
I love though.
Nicolas Cage.
What's in the box? You guys have to do 7. Eventually.
I know at some point. Absolutely.
Getting product approvals was also a huge pain, as most brands did not want to be associated with such a controversial film, chief among them being Rolex, Calvin Klein, and Ralph Lauren. It is Ralph Lauren, right? Yeah.
Everybody says Ralph Lauren, so I don't know.
I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm thinking of Sophia Loren. I don't know.
Maybe.
I'm white, but I'm not that fucking white. Perry Ellis, however, was totally okay with providing the underwear for the film. Well, right on, Perry Ellis.
Perry Ellis.
I remember that my dad used to wear Perry Ellis back in the day. Yeah. My Israeli father wearing Perry Ellis.
I gotta admit, sometimes I went to stores, I'm just like, damn, I like that shirt.
They have some good stuff.
Yeah, they do.
While prepping for the role, Christian Bale happened upon an interview with Tom Cruise on The Late Show with David Letterman and found his mannerism off-putting,
mm-hmm.
as if he was trying to be normal rather than being genuine. Oh my God, that is amazing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Isn't that
like,
right?
That is so spot on.
That's fucking on point right
And Christian
there.
Bale knew that before, like, the rest of the world knew that.
Oh, yeah.
Because, like, we're on to Tom Cruise now.
Yeah.
But back then, he was still, like, America's poster boy for normalcy in
a
way. And
he's the hero.
Right. Yeah. And he's awful. When referring to this, Bale says Cruise had, quote unquote, this very intense friendliness with nothing behind the eyes. Yeah, the dead eyes.
Yeah.
This became the basis for his portrayal of Patrick Bateman in the film. Throughout the duration of the shoot, Christian Bale would speak in his American accent even when cameras weren't rolling. Because of this, the crew assumed that was his native accent, so when he started speaking in his native Welsh accent, they all assumed he was prepping for his next role.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That's amazing.
That's how good of an actor he was.
I also like that he did a little method acting. Like, that's pretty cool. Bale also followed the same workout routine that Bateman describes in the film to stay in character. And this proved effective, as when it came time for his shower scene, all the women on the set gathered to watch.
You would have gathered.
I would have been there. I 1,000% would have been there. I am thirsty for Patrick Bateman. Maybe not Christian Bale, but I love me some murderous sexiness.
Like, let me see the ass. Put the water hotter.
I hate you, man. Quit calling me out, bro. Between takes during the chainsaw scene... I can't say chainsaw scene without laughing, because that scene always makes me laugh.
It's something else.
Considering he's butt naked with a chainsaw and
just with like
shoes
sprinting,
on.
But sprinting.
Where was I?
You're right there between
takes. Bale also wore nothing but a sock over his wiener and tennis shoes.
He did. Yeah. The whole time, he never put on a towel or nothing.
That's amazing.
And he's standing holding a bloody chainsaw with
the
prop blood
sock
on him.
Like Red Hot Chili Peppers. Oh, I have to rewatch that scene now.
With his American accent, too.
Oh,
he's just like,
amazing.
It's like, so you work in lighting, huh?
Oh, I'm gonna pay my pants. As filming wrapped up, the question of its rating was still hanging over the heads of everyone involved, considering the controversy surrounding the film. And even with such backlash already against it, they still had to premiere at Sundance.
Yep. As you know, in this podcast, Sundance makes or breaks a fucking
it
film.
It sure does.
No, it totally...
Sundance is a big deal.
It is. It's huge.
It's especially was back then.
Oh, yeah. And then fucking coronavirus. We're gonna be missing a lot of this shit. Anyways.
I don't want to hear that word.
I know. I don't want to hear shit either. So, hype for the film was so high that tickets to its premiere at Sundance were going for up to $200 from scalpers. That's big.
Yeah.
So when it finally came time for screening, it was actually, as expected, hugely divisive, with some critics praising it, going as far as to call it brilliant, while others absolutely loathe the violence in the film.
Mm.
Yeah. So the next hurdle was the MPAA, which slapped American Psycho with an NC-17 rating. This absolutely pissed off Mary Harron, who was vocally against the move, but the team managed to shave off 18 seconds from the violent threesome scene in the film, which managed to bring it down to an R rating. Oh, Sydney's doing the dance right now. that's
it's
one of those scenes,
on, right?
Too, though.
It's,
yeah, when he's flexing. Because I watched this film in high school. So it's one of those things, like, as... hanging out with the dudes, we were always just like, oh, look at fucking...
Because it's fucking great.
It's
if you're a woman, have you ever had a man Patrick Bateman you, then you know what I'm talking about, all right?
Oh, God. Anyways. Our boy Roger Ebert gave the film 3 out of 4 stars, saying, quote, "It's just as well a woman directed American Psycho. She transformed a novel about bloodlust into a movie about men's vanity," end quote. Ebert got it.
Can always count on our boy.
Yeah, you know, he's, you know, again, I don't always agree with
this. Saying our boy because I'm a fan of the podcast and I know they're a recurring joke.
But I don't always agree with his reviews, but when he says shit like that, I'm like, of course. Of course he's on the pulse.
I mean, he had that job for a reason.
Yeah, he was always ahead of his fucking time.
He was. He
absolutely.
Really was. He's dead now, right?
Yeah,
he's gone.
He had a very, very sad going.
R.I.P. Raj.
I serious. Drink a fucking clot of that shit,
yep,
right there.
Pour one out from a homie.
Pour one out right there, yeah. There, no, forgetting what I... Oh, keeping that in there.
Right.
So, Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly also praised the direction, stating, quote, "Harron, working with gleeful precision, mythologizes the moment when America rediscovered the heady, egomaniacal rush of... conspicuous consumption," end quote.
Say that 3 times fast.
Conspicuous, egomaniacal rush is what got me. That's
that whole quote. Yeah. I'm like, damn, girl. Yeah. I mean, Owen. Oops. I'm so like, yay, Mary Harron.
I know,
I'm
right?
Like, women, hey, yay. Hey,
she's getting the recognition.
She did a great job.
Serious.
So proud of her.
So, American Psycho finally released on April 14th, 2000. 3 months after Sundance, and not only was it financially successful, mm-hmm. making, of course, $34 million with a budget in the single digits, but it became a bona fide cult classic.
Yes, it did.
Oh, yeah. So while the reputation of the film was on the up and up, it did have one critic in the form of Bret Easton Ellis.
What?
Yeah. Though he was really more concerned with the necessity of it having to be made. He felt the medium just didn't lend well to what he was going for in the novel. He didn't like the way the film handled the unreliable narrator aspect of Patrick Bateman, but he did appreciate how it clarified the humor for general audiences, which I think is still a little condescending. Ellis's view is best summed up in this quote. "The movie was okay, the movie was fine. I just didn't think it needed to be made," end quote.
I think that's incredibly unfair.
Oh, it's going to get worse. So.
Great.
This take was put under more scrutiny, however, as some of Ellis's past comments on women directors put him under a lot of heat.
Oh, you better piss me off.
Yep.
Okay.
When asked about female directors, Ellis stated in an interview with MovieLine that, quote, "There's something about the medium of film itself that I think requires the male gaze. We're watching and we're aroused by looking, whereas I don't think women respond that way to films just because of how they're built," end quote. Oh, Sid is... There's more. Hey, there's more.
But okay, I'm just going to say this. I have been a fan of this film since I was like 12, mm-hmm. and I never knew that it was directed by a woman.
Right.
I 100% thought that it was directed by a man. So fuck you, Bret Easton Ellis.
Oh, you might say that again right now. Because a couple of years later, he had a few more words to say about Kathryn Bigelow's Oscar win for Zero Dark Thirty. Quote, "Kathryn Bigelow would be considered a mildly interesting filmmaker if she was a man. But since she's a very hot woman, she's really overrated." He went on to call her films okay junk. Yeah. Yeah.
I have nothing to say.
Yeah.
Because what is there to say? Yeah, he's clearly just not a nice person, so.
Old man energy right there.
Old white man energy.
Old white man energy. But this actually garnered major backlash in the early 2010s. And for a good sampling of this backlash, let's get to some of our favorite Letterboxd reviews. Sydney, break it down.
Let's do it while my ears are steaming. Oh. I was rooting for him. We were all rooting for him. Okay, so American Psycho has an average of 3.9 stars out of 5 on the platform with 12,000 reviews.
Which is huge. That's a
lot.
That
is huge.
That's
a it's lot. A cult classic, motherfuckers.
This shit goes for like 4K reviews per film. 12,000 is a lot.
It's a good film.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what freaking BEE has to say.
It's good.
Our girl Brat Pitt. Oh, I've heard reviews from her before.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's cool. Has this to say in her 4-star review of American Psycho. Quote unquote, "Bret Easton Ellis really had the nerve to say that women can't direct even after Mary Harron adapted his book into one of the most iconic films of all time." Huh? Oh, I love you, Brad Pitt. I love you, girl. You're the best. User Sri has a very particular reason for her rating. 5 stars for the brutal murder of Jared Leto. Is it Leto or Leto? It's Leto, right?
Yeah, Jared Leto.
I have to agree with you, Sri. I think that he's a tool. And there was recently something posted on Reddit.
Oh, yeah.
That he didn't know about coronavirus because he was like meditating or something. And I literally commented on it. He's a tool, and it got quite a bit of upvote, so I'm not the only one that thinks that.
Actually, there was another story I thought you were alluding to.
Oh, he has a cult. Different one? He has a cult?
He has a cult. Oh, it just God. Got revealed. He has a cult. He's essentially in the R. Kelly realm at this point.
No, you know what? Not to really go off topic, but I have heard some kind of sexual abuse allegations against him, in particular with young girls, so... Mm. I really don't like him. I really don't.
We'll see. The story's playing out as we speak. So.
Yep. Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, this is all allegedly. Yeah, I'm not gonna. We'll see. Yeah, we'll see. This is allegedly.
But then also, he's a white man, so might be brushed under the rug, you know?
Fucking white people, man.
It's okay.
You're making us other white people look bad.
Ah, yuppies.
Katie states in her 5-star review, "Relating to Patrick Bateman is a scary feeling, but thank God this film was made by women, or I think I might go insane." Right on, Katie.
Yeah, see, these people on Letterboxd know.
Yeah, they're film connoisseurs. Jay says in his 4-star review, as a graphic designer, I too start vigorously sweating at the sight of copper plate gothic typography on a business card. Jay, I like you.
I can understand that. I can get that.
Yep, I totally get it.
I work in graphics, I know.
That business card scene is one of my favorites. It's the best. It really is. And finally, Lauren comes in with 4 stars saying, yes, Patrick Bateman is an awful, terrible person who kills people. But do you know what he doesn't do? He doesn't let his friends get away with making anti-Semitic statements. Lauren, as a Jew, yeah. I applaud you.
Yeah, that's true.
Because that is one of my favorite fucking scenes. I know I've said that quite a few times, but I really do love the film. But yeah. I love that he was like, yeah, murdering fucking people, that's all right, but don't say anything bad about those fucking Jews.
And then he goes, and then we have to think about general social welfare. That's a good scene.
That's a goddamn good scene. American Psycho continues to be divisive to this day, though the general consensus is that both the novel and the film are, if anything, brilliant and worthy of discussion.
Yeah.
And here we are. Patrick Bateman has become a part of pop culture iconography, right?
Iconography. Right?
Thank you. Though not always in the way Ellis intended. Imagery from the film has been used in music videos by artists like Kanye West, Miles Fisher, and Maroon 5.
Yeah.
Stay away, Maroon 5. American Psycho even received a musical adaptation and a sequel, which starred Mila Kunis. We're not going to talk about it. And no, we're not going to talk about it. And I have to say, I was born in 1990, right? So a big part of my childhood was going to Blockbuster every Friday night with my best friend, Audrey. And we would pick up movies for the entire weekend. They were always horror movies. Every horror movie that I've seen during those formative years was due to the way that the artwork looked.
Yeah, exactly.
And I remember steering clear of American Psycho for so long because it was always paired with American Psycho 2. And I was just like, oh, these look like made-for-TV films. Yeah. I always coupled it up with that, so... Yeah, I've never seen American Psycho 2, so I don't have any opinion on it, but I've heard that it's not great. So.
Yeah, even Bret Easton Ellis was just like, it's supposed to be garbage, right?
Yeah, he's a tough critic. Mary Harron, unfortunately, didn't quite see the same success with her films that followed up American Psycho. The notorious Betty Page received mixed reviews at best, and Moth Diaries has a 13% on Rotten Tomatoes. She has, however, done a ton of great television projects, working on shows like Oz, 6 Feet Under, The L Word, and Big Love.
Yeah.
She worked on all of those?
She did. I think her directorial style lends to those kind of shows.
Oz and 6 Feet Under are iconic. I watched The L Word when I was younger, and I loved it back in the day. I just did a rewatch, and it's bad. it's really bad.
But cinematography-wise,
it looked great. In her next film, she will return to her punk roots and examine the rise of the scene in the 70s with a film called Please Kill Me, which is currently in development.
She's still going.
That's right up my alley.
I'm good with that.
Considering she was the first American whatever the fuck to interview the Sex Pistols, that'll be good.
This is in our hearts. Like, you can definitely tell.
When people care about things, you can tell.
Absolutely.
Christian became a bona fide movie star, earning numerous awards for his work and becoming the goddamn Dark Knight himself. Yeah, he's Christian fucking Bale. Exactly. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Bret Easton Ellis was also never quite able to escape the shadow of American Psycho, but he has seen success since its creation and has dabbled into screenwriting. He even adapted his own novel, The Canyons, into a film that might have one of the most controversial and chaotic productions ever. Hence my sigh.
Oh, you know about this.
I do. It stars Lindsay Lohan and porn star James Dean in a very difficult time in their real life Los Angeles lives. But that story might be a better fit for a different podcast.
Yeah, I can't go into that here.
No, let's not go into that, but it's so...
It's fascinating.
I know it because it's fascinating. It's fucking absolutely fascinating. And it's really sad that I see real in Los Angeles and I immediately think real estate.
Yeah.
Lists have been made as to where Bateman would eat if he were around today, and numerous videos and articles have popped up examining the character in the years since his creation. Even though he's a divisive figure, the character has become a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Agreed. On this, Ellis says, As the writer of American Psycho, I have no idea, and I can take no responsibility for why it has such resonance, though it might be that the moment we're living in now is, if anything, even more ripe for the metaphor of a serial killer.
Ooh.
Well said, but I still don't like you. So, this quote came in 2016 as Donald Trump, whom Bret Easton Ellis thought would fade away by the 90s, was rising within the Republican Party. On November 8th, 2016, the night Donald Trump won the presidency and the Republican Party took over the United States House and Senate, Bret Easton Ellis tweeted, "Somewhere, Patrick Bateman is smiling." Oh, that's great.
Ooh.
I'm not going to say anything. He has since deleted said tweet.
That's great.
He literally was like, "This is going to cost too much shit right now."
Yeah, he's smart. If anything, he is smart.
Oh, he's a genius.
On March 16th, 2020, less than a week ago, the Dow Jones had its largest drop in history, beating the record set on Black Monday in 1987. Though we haven't seen how many trillions we've lost quite yet. Fuck yuppies.
Yep. Oh, God. Right? They came back. And that, everyone, was
I'm going to hold my tongue, yeah. I'm going to hold my tongue. I don't want to get too political. This is very apropos for now.
It is.
It really is. It really is.
It's kind of why I wanted to cover it.
You are, if nothing, smart.
Thank you. And a little less misogynistic than Bret Easton Ellis.
Thank the Lord.
Oh, so... with that, Sydney, thanks again for helping out on this.
Yeah, and, of course. I hope you guys have enjoyed me.
Oh, gosh, but we still got something to get into.
Sure do.
So, I know the answer here, but what are your thoughts on American Psycho?
I love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. I could see where it would be polarizing and why people wouldn't like it. But if you don't like it, you're wrong and you don't get it.
Yeah. And stupid.
And stupid, yeah. And you're stupid, which is not a word that I use quite often. But no, I love the film. And if not for nothing, the setting, the time that it captured, the music. And to be honest, when I saw this as a kid, or, you know, going into my preteens, really, so I was, you know, really formative years for me.
Mm-hmm.
The fact, it was the way, my favorite part of the film was the way he talked about music.
Interesting.
I loved, because I'm a music nerd, I know music so well, thanks to my mom, my late uncle, like, music is ingrained in me, and music is the most important thing in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And, yes, he's a murderistic sociopath, but the way he talked about Huey Lewis in the News, the way he talked about Peter Gabriel and
Whitney Houston,
yeah. And just it really resonated with me. And seeing it at that age, I was like, I want to be able to talk about music like that one day. I was like, I want to be able to explain a Huey Lewis in the News album the way that he just did. Maybe not while fucking axing someone in the head, but no, it really did. It was really impactful on me. It was. Yeah.
Like there are some qualities in Bateman where I think you can kind of see where it resonates a little bit with people.
Absolutely.
But I mean, I think that's also part of it. Like, he disarms people in that way.
He's charming. That was the point.
That's why he's a fucking psycho right
yep,
there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, I saw this movie when I was a teenager, so I don't think it was preteens, but I think it was like 14.
Yeah.
Like in that, like, now
in the same realm.
I'm a teenager now.
Yeah.
And like, it was one of those things where it like really, really kind of captured, like, holy shit, like, is, I don't know, I never quite related to
it. It was impactful to you?
Yeah, but it kind of,
in what way?
Because it made me kind of identify behaviors that were like, oh, that's crazy, or that's the dead eyes and putting on the face.
Oh, so it kind of taught you how to look out for people with those same traits.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because a particular scene that always stood out was when they were like, well, we need to think about get rid of apartheid and da-da-da.
Yeah,
and like putting on the front. It taught me about fronts. But it also taught me about another thing that people always forgot who he was, because everyone was conforming. They're playing the part they want to be. And because of that, they all get lost in the fucking shuffle.
Which is how he got away with his bullshit.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But I mean, like, when people, like, get outraged over this film, like, there's a smart film with that's pretty...
It is. Odd. There's message. But you know what? People are going to get outraged about anything.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's just... it is what it is. And mm-hmm. to me, this is a work of art. It really is. It's saying yeah. something. And if it's riling people up, like I said earlier, it's doing its job.
Well, the thing is, I noticed a lot of people got riled up about it without having knowing shit about or even watching it. It's one of those things where it's like
monkey see, monkey do.
Yeah. It's the concept of like, oh, well, I heard this was like crazy violent. Yeah. Was like this,
so I don't like it.
So yeah. I'm not even going to bother. I'm just like, well, bother. Bother.
Like, ignorance is bliss, baby. That's ignorance true. Is bliss.
That's very, very true. So with that,
yes.
why do you think people are so fascinated by Patrick Bateman? And in what ways does this correlate with Donald Trump's own ascension? Yeah, that's a heavy one.
That's a heavy one. Okay, so without being too offensive, I think that to me, this is my opinion, people that relate to Donald Trump and that wanted him to succeed and all that probably were a bit racist, yes, but also thought he's a successful businessman.
Mm-hmm.
He is going to do good for our economy because, like you said, they don't know that he's a failed businessman. He's gone bankrupt a few times. Yeah. Yes, he had sold Trump steaks in the sharper image. Like, why are you selling fucking steaks in a fucking electronics store, you fool?
I mean,
he's not a good businessman. But that was also kind of like Patrick Bateman fooled people. You thought, oh yeah. he's too beautiful to be murderous and all of that. It's like
he disarms.
His disarms.
Status disarms.
Exactly.
His
and I think disarms. And those do go hand in hand. No, that's an amazing question, yeah. but it's also a loaded one because I don't want to say too much. I don't want to get too political, but
yeah.
I
mean, well to me the thing is with this whole scenario, like mm-hmm. it's of course the status and the facade, whatever it is.
Yeah,
but like,
it's the facade of the American dream.
Exactly. Yeah, but it's a dream that is simple. Like, yes. it's a very simple look. Like, if you look at the layers, look at the Dirty Money episode behind the Trump family, and you'll see...
You guys have to watch that.
Yeah, but you'll see, like, what it took and all the fucked upness that, like... And the thing is, like, when you see shit like that, it's one of those few things where I'm just like, well... If you're a regular Joe, why would you ever think that the person that does that is on your side? Why would you ever think if you're a regular Joe then you give your money to Patrick
exactly.
Bateman in Wall Street that he's going to make you money for you?
Those are the kind
you?
Of people that look down on you yeah. and don't give a fuck about you.
And Bateman clearly, again, somebody who, you know, the general person gives right. money to Patrick Bateman. You're betting your ass it's going to be his money before it becomes yours.
1,000%. That's like when, kind of similar to, not that I'm Gen Z or anything, but Kylie Jenner. When they ran that article on her about being the world's youngest billionaire in Forbes, but it wasn't true because she was at like 900 and something million. She hadn't actually quite hit billion. And people were donating money to her to make her a
over?
Billionaire. God. I'm like... Stop.
Dude,
she doesn't give a
there.
Fuck about you.
She doesn't. And
she just wants
there.
You to buy her mediocre lip kits. Like, stop.
Just like Bateman was like, he would screw you out of your money so he can go to fucking get that restaurant reservation and pay for the steak dinner.
Yep. And do some lines of coke in
and
the bathroom.
Do some lines of coke in the bathroom. Exactly. And pay for the hookers that he can fuck up. it's psychotic. Which, again, the name American Psycho is very, very apt.
It is. It's a lack of empathy for other human beings, which is something I don't jive with.
It's also fascinating, though, because,
it
again,
is.
The facade is good enough to where
yeah.
if you're not looking at that layer, you're enthralled by it. It's almost – it's intoxicating. It's like watching Entourage as a dude.
Exactly. I mean, or as me, because I loved Entourage,
that's
too.
True.
Let's hug it out, bitch.
but at the same time, it's one of those things where, like, that, like, hyper-masculine is a focus.
1,000%. It's a personification
of
everything that they want, you
yeah.
know? Like, look at what you can have.
Look at, yeah, like, you could fuck anybody you want and
right.
drive this car.
And,
all you gotta
yep.
do is play this role. And, yeah, it's gonna get a little fucked up, but look what you get to do.
Right.
Yep.
Because stuff and things are so important,
commercialism,
right?
consumerism, all these great things that we're being... You know, we get commercials every fucking day trying to watch Hulu. It's a feedback loop. That's all it is, really.
1,000%.
Yeah, and
1,000%.
That's the imagery of the feedback loop that people ultimately want to engage in, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, big question. Fuck.
Yeah.
Oh.
You wrote this for a reason.
Yeah.
Good, pal.
So how do you feel, though, about the mass protest and controversy surrounding the release of both the novel and the film?
I've always... hated anything that protests art. I've
okay.
always like I remember the I remember having banned books in school. Like
mm-hmm.
I remember Nabokov's Lolita being a banned book, and I don't think that works of art should be banned because they are fictional. And yes, I understand too much violence and too much first person shooter and all that can fuck with kids' heads. But I do think that as in your adolescence or whatever, you should be exposed to certain things because it builds character and it shows you right from wrong. And the more you try to censor something, the more people are going to want to engage with it. So it's like, just stop.
Well, they
you're making a big deal out of nothing.
They turned the festival tickets into $200 from scalpers to see it at Sundance. That's the backfire.
Which would have made me want to go and see. You know what I mean? Like, I completely would have been intrigued.
Or
I mean,
think NWA.
Yep.
When they bought their records and burned them in front of the fucking studio, and people just wanted to buy more records, and they still got the sales from them buying the records that got burned.
there's
a way to handle outrage, and that type of the way that gives it more press and makes it feel more dangerous because it's dangerous doesn't work.
It just doesn't work.
So I think the protests were misled and not even in the right head, because really, realistically, these came from people getting summations from Vanity Fair. They didn't read the novel.
Exactly. Like I said, monkey see, monkey do. It's like about the concerned Canadians, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And how none of them had even read the fucking novel. Like, what are you so concerned about, you fucking Canadians? You haven't even read the goddamn thing.
No disrespect to our Canadian listeners.
No, I love Canada. One of my best friends is from Nova Scotia. I've been to Toronto, and I want to go to Banff. So don't come for me, please.
Oh, my God. That's...
Do you have Canadian listeners?
A couple. Less so than some of... We have a lot of UK listeners.
Oh, yeah, right.
I know, right. And they loved American Psycho. It's the Germans.
Because fucking British people are cool, right?
They get it.
They don't give a fuck.
Yeah. So what is your take, though, overall on yuppie culture? And do you see traces of it in our current day right now?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
Yuppies never died. It was just, you have to understand too, in the 80s, it was the beginnings of a lot of things. It was the beginnings of mall culture.
Yeah.
It was beginnings of credit card culture. It was the beginnings of, like you said, yuppie culture. And, you know, anytime something is new, it's exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Now we see yuppie culture in like think about those like YouTube celebrities and all of that. These like
Jordan
I said,
Peterson
fuck boys and all these kids that have tons of money and they don't know what to do with it. I think the difference is back then people had more class. I hate to say that, but you know, the yuppies were a little more, how do I say this? They were a little more, they had more class. I'm trying to look for a better way to say it, but they did. Now you see, I mean, we live in LA, so we see the Beverly Hills and the Hollywood Hills yuppies, and to me they're still yuppies, but they're driving around in G-Wagons and they're wearing Gucci loafers, and but
the style
has changed, but it is still the same principle. They're still young urban professionals, I guess.
Sometimes it's just like they're the children of 80s yuppies that happen to be able to enjoy that lifestyle.
That enjoy that lifestyle. Yeah. But a lot of them are self-made because of today's society.
Oh, well, that's another point I'm thinking right here, because you're right. They were a little more classy, definitely in the 80s.
Yeah.
However, I feel like if they had front-facing cameras on their telephones, wouldn't be the case.
You're so fucking right.
If they were just like, I'm at this restaurant right now, and this waiter fucking served me this, and takes a photo, this many fucking likes, like, that's where we'd be. But we're at, everything's so accessible now, and we have an oversaturation of so many things, including podcasting, unfortunately.
That is what it is.
Yeah, limitations.
They probably didn't have any motherfucking class. They just didn't have anybody around to record them not having class. Yeah,
they had the, like, I mean, one of them did become the goddamn president. You're going to tell me that guy has class?
He has none.
No, no, no.
None.
And that was the yuppie of the yuppies. So
he's a poster boy. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. And he didn't have a front-facing camera until now, and his face is too old to take a clear picture that he wants.
Orange.
Yep.
Bye.
I don't know. Yuppie culture again. I don't think it obviously never left, but I think it had a very disrespectful connotation for years.
Yeah.
For like two decades at least, maybe even three.
Maybe even three. Yeah,
but
absolutely.
Once 2016 came around, that was disputed. And that's where we're at right now. Mm-hmm. Because now that it, now that our overall, I think, conversation in anything is image based, it's image is what's key. And you make image with money. So that's where we're at right now. Yuppies have more changed. Ammo. They have more ammo.
Nothing has changed.
But I mean, like everything, I'm pretty sure the backlash is going to be fucking harsh. But we'll see when that time comes, because it's not coming right now.
It will.
Not when we're all stuck in these indoors. Yeah.
I know.
Yep.
Like, ooh. I said, we're not going there.
Yeah.
Positive thoughts.
So actually, what do you think of the film's approach to masculinity?
Ooh.
Yeah.
Huh,
it was a tough one,
that's
huh?
That's a tough one. Like I said, if you would have told me that that film was directed by a woman, I wouldn't have believed you, because mm-hmm. I definitely thought that it was from a male perspective. I don't want to use the term toxic masculinity, but there was definitely, I think, toxic masculinity, considering mm-hmm. he was killing sex workers.
Yeah.
But I also, I don't want to say he was gentlemanly. I feel like I'm...
No, that would give him too much credit.
Be giving him way too much credit, but I don't know. I think it portrayed him as... I'm going to get in trouble here. What did you think about the film's take on masculinity? Can you help me out here, man?
I think... It is a satirical take on that toxic masculinity. It is an extreme version.
I mean, everything's satirical about this film.
No, but that's the thing, though.
Yeah.
Like, I think the people who, again, in that one Letterboxd review, like, if somebody acts like this, run away. If somebody's glorifying this, absolutely. Run away, because you shouldn't glorify it. But what you see in it could be intoxicating, but you know it's an extreme version. Nobody's going to have all that.
It's incredibly intoxicating. That's why I feel it did. That's what I'm saying. Like, it captured masculinity in a, I don't want to say good way, but it definitely captured it. Like,
yeah. And where you can
I
see
found myself being attracted to Patrick Bateman, and I'm like, no, but like, Sydney, stop.
I think that's part of how it's supposed to disarm you, though.
Yeah.
Like, it disarms you because it's supposed to make it look appealing, but it also shows you underneath just how stone cold it is.
Right.
At its most extreme levels. Which
happens in real life all the fucking time.
All the time. All the time.
Am I right, ladies? Gentlemen.
Oh, yeah. No, we've all been there. So.
Absolutely. Thank you.
With people with money, too. Yeah, fucking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but I think it really is like what Roger said. It's like it shows the vanity in a way that is humorous, but also extreme.
Yep.
Very, very extreme.
Yep.
And sometimes people are drawn to the extreme in a way that they take it in a way they realistically shouldn't. But it's out there.
Right.
And that's what's the part that sticks out more than the message underneath. You know, it's
well said, friend.
Thanks.
Well said.
Coming in the clutch right there to help you out with that one.
I just heard masculinity and I was like, what?
You're like,
yes.
I don't want to say it's like awesome. But I can
I
see
want
why
say
it looks
I was
awesome.
Turned on, but yeah. I still liked it.
Oh, jeez.
Anyway,
but you
next
shouldn't
question.
Feel bad about that. You
I sure
should.
As
no,
fuck don't, because
no,
I'm a hedonist and I never feel bad about anything.
Well, how do you think though this movie would look like if it was directed by either Cronenberg or Oliver Stone?
I don't think that it would have been as effective, and I don't think that they would have got it.
No,
because I don't think they got it like Mary did.
I don't think it would have been good.
I have to agree. Mm-mm. Because if you don't get the film, you don't get that, like, yes, it's creepy and yes, it's wrong and all of this, but at the very basis of it, it's like, we're also supposed to laugh at this because it is ridiculous. Like, that business card scene, like, really?
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Stone or
they
Cronenberg
would not have been able
not.
To. No, they're no. too artsy fartsy, man, no. for lack of a better word. They would have tried to make it too serious, in my opinion.
You know who would have done good, though?
Hmm.
David Lynch.
Fuck yes.
Dude, David Lynch would have knocked
David
shit
Lynch
out of the
could
park.
Turn a turd into gold.
But,
so.
Like, that business card scene with David Lynch's acting direction?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
But let's not take any credit away from Mary.
Oh, hell no. Hell no.
All right.
Hell no. Which actually brings me to my next question.
Okay.
What are your thoughts on Mary Harron's experience even just getting the film made from, like, an overall Hollywood perspective?
I think she I'm really proud of her for playing the Hollywood game like she did. Like how you mentioned, what was it that she like held her tongue and she kept, you know, she kept it cool and
with the people she knew played, she had to keep it cool.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But then she was venting to Christian Bale, like she got him on her side. She showed him, you know, I'm a human being. But yet to all these Hollywood phonies, she was playing, and that's hard to do, man. That's, to play politics and stuff. I've worked in the corporate world. Like, let me tell you. It's not easy.
No, fuck it. No, that's it. Quarantine. Quarantine.
That is literally my inner being, like, rejecting the corporate world.
You're like, hold on. I remembered my time, and I got to throw up my mouth a little bit.
No, but, you know, I feel bad that she initially, like, how you said Lionsgate.
Went over her head.
Went over her head and announced it. Yeah, like, that's fucked up, man. And I just... as a woman, not to be too feminist or too like, yay, women, but it does, it really makes me proud that, and even back then too, you know, even 20 years ago, things were very different.
Yeah.
I'm really proud of you, Mary. No, you did it. You really did. And you did a fantastic fucking job.
She did as best as she could in her circumstances, which were 100% against her.
Which were like 1,000% against her. But she did such a good job at playing those politics that she had Lionsgate coming to her with their tail tucked between their legs. Like,
well, yeah.
That's fucking amazing.
Not only that, though, the big thing I take away from this, which doing this podcast, a lot of people have a hard time doing, she made the movie she wanted to make. That never happens. That's something that's like, that holy
is
shit.
A unicorn, my friends.
Yeah.
That is a fucking unicorn.
Oh my God. And made a profit.
Just made an amazing profit.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, another side effect is made Patrick Bateman such a glorifying character that people take the wrong message. Well, she was too good. She was too good. I mean, that also has to do with the way Bret Easton Ellis did it, like combined. It was literally...
There's always going to be idiots taking the wrong fucking message, you know? Exactly. You can't, you know, we are in America, guys.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
So, with that...
Yes.
What would you rate American Psycho out of 5 tracks from Huey Lewis and the News' 1986 album 4, which features their undisputed masterpiece, Hit to Be Square? Out of how many tracks?
5 out of 5, man. Yeah. For me, this is a perfect film.
Yeah.
I love it. I love Christian Bale in it. I love everything about it. And I especially love the soundtrack, which features the undisputed masterpiece, Hip to Be a Square. And it is Hip to Be a Square, guys. Follow the status quo.
You know what, though? I know this is my birthday month, and I picked all the movies, and I picked all good ones. I'm giving it a 5 also. This is a 5 for me.
Why I fuck with you.
Yeah, that's why I've been friends for so goddamn long, because Jesus.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, it's one of those, like, again, if you have this preconceived notion of the film, which a lot of people do.
Yeah.
A lot of people do.
1,000%, yeah.
I say just give it a shot. Give it a shot. And if, because a lot of people I've read also at first don't like it. But maybe watch some YouTube videos, watch some analysis, because it's there. And it's being uploaded every year, every month. There's always a new thing on Patrick Bateman. The research for this fucking podcast, I had a lot to work with. Because want to know. They want to know.
So. It's a cult classic. Once you become a cult classic, like, come on, just watch the goddamn
film. No, I agree. Make your own assessment.
Make your own assessment. Watch it from beginning to end. It's good. Yes. Like, I know films, goddamn it. Watch it.
Well, thank you for being on
the podcast. Thank you for having me. Thank you, everybody, for listening to my voice. And this has been a pleasure.
Yeah. And a text update. Alex is doing better.
Yay.
So, yes, she's doing better.
We're okay. I love her.
Yeah. So where can people find you? And what other projects are you working on? All the good stuff.
Where can people find me? My Instagram is SidFictitious.
Good, like, fucking name.
You know, rhymes with Sid Vicious. Once again, obsessed with 2 dead junkies when I was 13. And I am working on my own podcast, actually. It will be a podcast about Los Angeles. I'm not going to say the name of it just yet because it has not released, but... if you fuck with me and you liked what I've been dropping during this podcast, then stay tuned, my friends.
Yeah, no, we'll definitely give a little preview shout out for that one when it comes out.
Thank you very much.
And it's a very brilliant concept, so you guys...
thank you very much.
Look out for it. Of course, you can find me at Hyrulean Hustler. You can find Alex...
nerd.
...who's not here. Oh, yeah, dude. Fuck yeah.
Ghost Coffee Shop. I'm obsessed with her, and I know her Instagram handle off the top of my head.
Instagram and Twitter, of course. You can find our podcast on the Horrible People's Podcast on Instagram. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Horror People Pod. And next week, If you do follow us on those platforms, we are going to do a film that our listeners chose. So, and
I didn't know that.
I'm already going to spoil it because it was out on social media, but we're covering Eli Roth and Cabin Fever to kick off April.
I love Eli Roth. Yeah. That's so exciting.
We get to explore a new director. It's going to be fucking fascinating. And Alex is writing that one, so you know it's going to be good.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic.
So, yep. And with that, I'm pretty sure I have more stuff to say. Oh, right. Give us a 5-star rating. For my birthday, you know, it's still March.
It really helps him out. It makes a big deal. Take those 2 seconds out of your day and write something nice about my friends.
And we're all isolated now, so you can do it.
Right, you have nothing better to do. You have literally nothing to do.
All you got to do is in your favorite podcast app, type in one word, Horror Bee. We come up right away because you are Horror Bees and we love you. So,
and remember, folks, don't just stare at it. Eat it.
I'm going to let it go on that one. See you guys later. We love you. Peace out. Fuck yuppies.
Later.